Today is February 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. As top U.S. and Russian diplomats speak to each other again, U.S. President Biden says diplomacy is first in resolving the Ukraine dispute.
With Russia's continuing its buildup of its forces around Ukraine, we are ready no matter what happens.
The Webb Space Telescope is up and running.
The good news that we have is that all the science instruments have been turned on. So that is a very recent development.
And coronavirus vaccine may soon be available for children under 5. We'll have these stories and more next. As the world waits to see whether Russia will invade Ukraine, the war of words is picking up steam, with top diplomats from the U.S. and Russia going head-to-head at the United Nations and President Joe Biden vowing the U.S. is ready no matter what happens. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Strong words from U.S. President Joe Biden as the drama deepens between Moscow and Washington.
We continue to urge diplomacy as the best way forward. But with Russia's continuing its buildup of its forces around Ukraine, we are ready no matter what happens.
Washington is talking tough as Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to deploy thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border, not just within Russian territory, but also in Belarus. The White House says more than 105,000 Russian troops nearly encircle Ukraine. Russia objects to Ukraine's attempt to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and has demanded that the U.S., the most powerful member of the Collective Security Alliance, bar Ukraine's entry. The top U.S. diplomat at the United Nations on Monday called for the Security Council to discuss the matter publicly after months of private discussions between the U.S. and Russia. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
The situation we're facing in Europe is urgent and dangerous, and the stakes for Ukraine and for every UN member state could not be higher. Russia's actions strike at the very heart of the UN Charter. This is as clear and consequential a threat to peace and security as anyone can imagine.
Russia fired back with its ambassador saying it does not intend to invade.
You want it to happen. You're waiting for it to happen, as if you want to make your words become a reality. This is despite the fact that we are constantly rejecting these allegations. And this is despite the fact that no threat of a planned invasion into Ukraine from the lips of any Russian politician or public figure over all of this period has been made.
The dispute between two nuclear-armed nations is about more than differing worldviews, says analyst Angela Stent, speaking to VOA via Skype. A stable Europe is central to U.S. interests, and sending more than $200 million worth of security assistance to non-NATO Ukraine is part of that.
It's not only ideology, it's security. I mean, it's, you know, a system of alliances and a stable European continent, which are in the U.S.'s interests. We don't live in isolation. You know, we're not on we're a very large island with two neighbors, right? We're a continent. But so it's more than that. It's not about ideology. It's about power politics, but it's also about principles, which do have to do with territorial integrity and sovereignty.
Meanwhile, Russia and top U.S. rival China have become ever closer. Beijing expressed its dissatisfaction when Russia invaded Georgia as China was hosting the 2008 Olympics. The Chinese capital will host the Winter Games starting this week. With the U.S. threatening heavy sanctions against Russia and even against Putin himself, Moscow will need support from the world's second largest economy if it invades Ukraine. Analysts say this could play out slowly as the Olympics take center stage and Washington continues to remind Moscow of the consequences of an invasion. Andrew Lozen, a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, via Zoom.
If it does move into Ukraine, then the economic measures that the United States and others are going to bring to bear, you know, to a certain extent, will push them even further into a junior relationship with China, which is just going to hurt their economy in the long run. I don't really see a lot of strong outcomes here. So that's one of the reasons why I think that a diplomatic outcome might still be on the table, but Russia's going to try to you know, let the clock run as long as possible to let us feel uncomfortable.
And so, as the games begin in Beijing and military positioning continues on both sides of Ukraine's border, the diplomatic standoff between distant rivals endures. Anita Palvioy News, Washington.
Several NATO member states are sending troops and hardware to allies in Eastern Europe as tensions with Russia escalate. The United States has put several thousand troops on alert. Moscow has over 100,000 troops stationed along the border with Ukraine, and the West fears an imminent Russian invasion, which the Kremlin denies. Henry Ridgewell looks at NATO's military response and what it means for the brinkmanship between Moscow and the Western alliance.
A show of solidarity. Four Danish F-16 fighter jets landed in Lithuania last week to bolster NATO's air policing mission in the Baltic. Since Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea in 2014, NATO has deployed around 5,000 troops in Eastern Europe in what the alliance terms an enhanced forward presence. The US has put an additional 8,500 troops on standby.
I'll be moving U.S. troops to Eastern Europe and the NATO countries in the near term.
France announced plans to deploy hundreds more troops to Romania, while Spain, the Netherlands and Germany are also considering sending more troops, aircraft and warships. Britain has supplied around 2,000 anti-tank weapons to Ukraine and is expected to offer further deployments to NATO allies this week.
I think it's important when it comes to military deployment that we signal to President Putin that the very thing he fears, which is more NATO closer to Russia, would be a consequence of a strategic error of invading a sovereign country such as Ukraine.
NATO has no plans to deploy combat troops to Ukraine.
Those NATO troops that are in those border states are really there more for for preparedness and for defensive and deterrence capability rather than the expectation for a direct conflict or direct combat.
NATO says it is responding to Russian aggression. Moscow called the response hysteria. Russia has around 100,000 troops deployed close to the Ukrainian border. Thousands more arrived in Belarus for joint military exercises this week.
NATO itself has had to respond to a new threat that Russia posed by putting additional forces into Belarus, which of course shares a border with Poland, Latvia, and Lithuania, which are NATO allies.
NATO's deployments could ratchet up tensions further with Russia's president, says Norman.
One of Putin's key demands in all of this is the drawdown of NATO troops and weaponry from those same eastern states. So the fact that there is more buildup there is going to be seen not as an act of defense, but an act of offense and provocation by Russia.
Meanwhile, the flurry of diplomatic efforts to avoid war continues. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is due to visit Ukraine this week and hold talks on the phone with Russia's president. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The U.S. military has launched intercept missiles during an attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels that targeted the United Arab Emirates during a visit by Israel's president. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
The missile's launch on Monday represents the second such time American troops have opened fire. Officials at both the White House and the Pentagon confirmed the U.S. launched Patriot missiles. It represents a widening American involvement in Yemen's years-long war, a conflict that President Joe Biden declared nearly a year ago has to end. The Houthis have declared Al Dhafra Air Base in Abu Dhabi a target. Al Dhafra hosts some 2,000 American troops. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Drug maker Pfizer is expected to soon apply for emergency authorization to provide a two-dose COVID vaccine for children under the age of five. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
U.S. regulators have been urging Pfizer to apply for authorization to vaccinate youngsters from 6 months to 5 years old. According to a person with inside information, with the Biden administration hoping to be able to clear the shots by the end of this month, early Pfizer data shown the diluted version of the adult vaccine is safe and does produce an immune response. But last year, Pfizer said it was less effective for kids ages 2 to 5, and it's studying the need for a third shot. The insider says the Food and Drug Administration's been pushing Pfizer to file its application for the two-dose regimen to enable shots to start by the end of the month and then come back once it has the full data. regarding a third dose. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Hong Kong's media leaders and journalists are adjusting to the challenging environment as they navigate a national security law that was instituted by Beijing. VOA's Laurel Bowman has this report.
First to fall in June 2021 was Apple Daily and its founder, Jimmy Lai. The newspaper that praised Hong Kong's 2019 pro-democracy movement was loathed by Beijing's leadership. With its executives charged under the national security law, the paper's assets were frozen. Lai, an outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, is now in prison. For many Hong Kongers, the newspaper's demise sent a chill. Stephen Liu is a Hong Kong resident.
It's like death, because Hong Kong is supposed to have freedom of press and speech. If the last organization that speaks for Hong Kong disappears, I don't want to live here anymore.
Apple Daily was not the last. In late December, National Security Police raided the pro-democracy news website Stand News. Its assets were frozen and boxes of evidence, including computers, phones, and journalistic materials, were carted away. Crowds showed up in support of two editors who had been charged with sedition. Their arrests came even after Stan News had said it would cease operations. The risk of lawsuits is changing how media think, says Ronson Chan, a former Stan News journalist who chairs the Hong Kong Journalists Association. Police spent 5 hours searching his sparse apartment. Chan spoke to VOA via Skype.
No one could escape from the law, from the NSL. So you may bear very high risk if you do something very sensitive or something. So I feel quite sad about the future of this journalism in Hong Kong.
A week later, Citizen News threw in the towel. Daisy Lee was chief editor at Citizen News.
I am unsure whether a story, a piece of news, or a sentence will violate a new regulation under the changing news environment. If I can't confidently let my reporters continue to do what we are doing, then I should stop. As a leader, I am responsible for journalists, after all.
She added that journalists need to feel safe in their jobs. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam says Western governments critical of the news outlets' closures don't understand Hong Kong law. Journalists are respected, but they must practice their trade properly, she says.
If you breach the law but package yourself as a practitioner in the press, then we need to see through that, to be able to tell what's actually happening, and the law enforcement department should take action.
Press freedom advocates say it's a precarious time to be a journalist in Hong Kong.
I think here in Hong Kong at the moment, journalists are distressed. They're frightened. They're despairing. But they're trying to get on with their jobs as best they can. I mean, it's a tough time if you know Hong Kong the way it used to be. This place used to be probably the freest in Asia, this part of the world for the press.
Now, with pro-democracy media closing and laws making journalists wary of covering political news, that freedom appears limited. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson apologized and vowed to fix it after a report on Monday into lockdown parties held at his Downing Street residence criticized serious failures at the heart of government. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony reports.
And I'm sorry for the things we simply didn't get right, and also sorry for the way that this matter has been handled.
Yet another apology from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday. His response to a newly released report into COVID-19 lockdown parties allegedly held at his Downing Street residence. The investigation by senior civil servant Sue Gray highlighted serious failures of leadership and judgment at the heart of government and condemned some of the behaviour by authority figures as being, quote, difficult to justify. Johnson said his government would learn from these criticisms.
Mr. Speaker, I get it and I will fix it. And I want to say... And I want to say to the people of this country, I know what the issue is. Yes, Mr. Speaker, yes, yes. It's whether this government can be trusted to deliver. And I say, Mr. Speaker, yes, we can be trusted. Yes, we can be trusted to deliver.
The inquiry said that some events at Number 10 during the pandemic should not have taken place. But so as not to prejudice an ongoing police probe into the parties that could take months, Gray said she could not offer a meaningful report, and only an abridged version of her text has been released. The commander overseeing the police investigation, Catherine Roper, says authorities plan to contact people with questions about the parties. Johnson has so far survived calls from opponents and some in his own party to resign by saying people needed to wait for Gray's report. For now, he must hope that his Conservative colleagues do not trigger a confidence vote against him in a bid to thrust him from office. It is not clear what will happen if the police report shows evidence that Downing Street parties did in fact break the law.
That was Lauren Anthony with Reuters. The James Webb Space Telescope recently reached its final destination in space, a million miles from Earth. Now that the Webb Space Telescope is fully deployed in its orbit, I asked Webb Space Telescope Project Director Dr. Klaus Pontoppidan, what are the next steps in commissioning that prevent scientists from seeing images right away?
We have a segmented telescope consisting of 18 segments. And what that means is that we still have to align all those segments and focus them to allow the telescope to work, as a focused telescope. And that is a long process. This has never been done before in space. And so it takes months to do that, sort of in a painstakingly way.
Are you talking about the mirrors unfolding, or they're already unfolded, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the mirrors are already unfolded, but they have to be placed to an accuracy of 10 or 20 nanometers. So this is very high precision. And so that is what is a long process. Otherwise, we won't get focused images.
I see. And what exactly do you mean by commissioning anyway?
Well, commissioning means going from this unfocused, warm, unfolded telescope to a telescope that can be used for science. So there are many steps in between launching and actually being able to do the science that scientists all around the world want to do with it.
How long will that take now to position everything the way you want it so that it's exactly pointing in the direction and everything just the way? And I imagine that over time you're going to adjust those too, right?
Yeah. So all of commissioning, getting the observatory ready for science, is a 6-month long process. And we're about 5 weeks into that. So there's a long way to go yet. But we're excited, and it is a necessary step.
We know that your destination is about a million miles away from Earth, but why did you guys pick L2? What is so perfect about L2 for the Webb telescope compared to L1, L3, L4?
So there's several aspects of that. One is that Webb is an infrared telescope. And as an infrared telescope, it has to be really cold. It has to be, almost minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit on the cold side, on the other side of the sun shield. And if we were in low Earth orbit, like the Hubble Space Telescope is, then Earth would heat up the telescope and just wouldn't work. So a million miles away is a very cold spot in space. The L2 halo orbit is also a great orbit because it keeps the telescope from drifting away from Earth. So it doesn't go farther away, and that helps us communicate with it. We are going to get a lot of data. We need a high rate of data downlink from the observatory. If you go too far away, it gets too slow, like a slow internet connection. So it allows us to...
Well, we can all relate to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of science data have you scientists received so far, if any?
So the good news that we have is that all the science instruments have been turned on. So that is a very recent development. So now we know they're all alive. The next steps are to start getting not science data, but the actual starlight on one of the cameras. So this is the camera called NearCam. This is the one we use to focus the telescope with. So the first images that we're going to get from that are going to be these very unfocused images of a bright star. So it's not science images, but it's an important step, and we actually see that we have light on the detector.
That was Dr. Klaus Pentapadon. He's project director of the James Webb Space Telescope Science Institute. He was speaking to me Tuesday from Baltimore, Maryland. Tomorrow, Dr. Pentapadon tells us what celestial images scientists expect to see from the Webb telescope. A French government spokesman says President Emmanuel Macron plans to wait before officially declaring he will seek a second term in April elections, with Ukraine and coronavirus still high on his agenda. This week's presidential schedule, released on Monday, sparked speculation that Macron might announce his candidacy on Thursday or Friday when no formal events are planned, but a spokesman ruled that out. Voice of America is marking its 80th anniversary this month. One of the longest-serving staffers is senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi, who has racked up a slew of awards during his career at VOA, which spans more than four decades. I've had the pleasure of working with Mohammed in English to Africa these past several years. To mark VOA's anniversary, we connected via Microsoft Teams last week to share some of his experiences at the Voice of America. We began our three-part conversation by talking about how he got his start at VOA.
You've been with VOA for more than four decades, so obviously you've seen a few things. Tell us a little bit about how you started in radio and where you went from there.
Well, Carol, I came from another VOA, that's the Voice of the Arabs in Radio Cairo in 1978. In Cairo, an announcer is well-trained to do all kinds of radio programming, but has very limited freedom when it comes to news coverage. So when I came here, I adapted my radio expertise to fit VOA charter, which protects the independence and integrity of news coverage and requires objective and balanced coverage. My first program in the Arabic service was Good Morning Western, in which I provided our audience with aspects of American life, Americana as we call, with some American pop and country music. Over my long years at VOA, which is 44 years next June, I acquired a variety of expertise. For programming in the Arabic service, I introduced programs like Accent on Youth, portraying how American youth live, how do they do sports, education, volunteering, and what have you. Another program that I introduced was Life in America, showcasing different aspects of American life. And in political sphere, I introduced a panel discussion called Experts Panel, where I would bring two opposite sides of an issue and present a dialogue of the opposites. I vividly remember one episode where I brought a political Islam promoter and a liberal thinker who believes strongly in separation of state and religion. VOA Bureau Chief in Cairo told me thousands of listeners exchanged cassettes of the program because it was their first time to hear a debate between the two opposite sides.
I remember those days with cassettes. That was quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been something for you. Was that really, really unusual in the country at that time for, you know, you to have one person on that side of the political spectrum and then one on the completely opposite side and kind of meeting face to face?
Well, till this moment, it's not available in Egypt. So we were ahead of time then.
Besides that, what are some of your biggest memories during your 44 years of covering events at VOA?
Well, covering the first peace agreement ever between an Arab state and Israel in Camp David in 1979, it was live. When peace with Israel was a taboo in the Arab world, this stands as a milestone in my VOA biggest memories.
That was Mohammed Al-Shanawi talking about his memories as a journalist at VOA. In the second part of our conversation tomorrow, Mohammed remembers other highlights of his long career. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, we're so glad you could join us on International Edition. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.